Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media, a handful of first state charter schools, including some that have yet to open, face increased state scrutiny. We explain why. As Delaware's Jewish community observes Holocaust Remembrance Week, we speak with a filmmaker whose documentary focuses on first state Holocaust survivors.
People who appear in the documentary never talked about this ever. Not with their children, not with their husbands, not with their wives, not with their friends. The impact has been pretty powerful.
Steve Gonser, producer and director of No Denying, Delawareans Bear Witness to the Holocaust, joins us. The Delaware Theater Company has a Broadway-bound musical.
I could say something very mercenary and just be like, yeah, we're trying to get the Annie kids or the Wicked kids of 2015, but it does have a very broad appeal.
In our arts playlist, we chat with composer Duncan Sheik and writer Nell Benjamin of Because of Winn-Dixie. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. That and more is next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the latest news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This week, the State Board of Education okayed Education Secretary Mark Murphy's request to give four charter schools further state scrutiny. Two of the schools placed under formal review, Design Lab and Freire, are high schools set to open this fall. Those schools, along with the all-boys charter school Prestige Academy, came up short on enrollment goals. Prestige also faces questions about academic performance. A fourth school placed under review, Academy of Dover Elementary, faces both academic and financial management issues. Contributor Larry Nagengast has more on the problems these schools face in his piece, available now at DelawarePublic.org. And I sat down with him to discuss them further. Two of the schools under formal review are two charters slated to open this fall, Design Lab and Freire. Both have enrollment issues, which we discussed previously on this show. Where do those two schools stand right now? Is their ability to open in the fall in question?
Well, technically, their ability to open in the fall is in question. I would surmise that the more likely situation is that outcome is that they're going to move from this formal review status onto a form of probation with whatever conditions the people at the charter schools office and the Department of Education would specify. I say that because there is a precedent. There was a school last year, Academia Antonio Alonso, that was well below its enrollment numbers at this time last year. It was put on formal review, and it managed to continue enrolling students and reached its target by September. And in fact, Academia was taken off probation on Thursday by the State Board of Education.
It would appear that the numbers that we're seeing with Freire and Design Lab are not altogether different than the ones we saw with Academia Antonio Alonso. So is there a roadmap that school, Academia Antonio Alonso, has provided maybe that these schools can follow?
Yes and no. The numbers actually are a little bit better for Design Lab and Freire than they were for Academia. The schools are a little bit different. Academia is a dual language Spanish English immersion sort of program at the lower elementary level, starting with kindergarten and first grade. Design Lab and Freire are high schools, so there's a difference there. But I mean, there was a lot of intense marketing and knocking on doors and that sort of thing that Academia got into once it saw how it was in deep trouble with its numbers last spring. Design Lab has already begun that sort of thing, the ice cream socials and skating parties.
And let's talk about the other school with enrollment issues, and that is the all-boys charter Prestige Academy. That school, though, also faces academic questions. What's its status? And in some ways, does this look like it could be a repeat of what happened with the all-girls charter Reach Academy?
I'm going to say it could be. Prestige has pretty much been below standards on just about every measure on the state's assessment over the last 3 or 4 years. So the academic performance is subpar, although the school has developed a pretty good reputation in some quarters for just the kind of the orientation of the program. Jack Perry, the school leader, had developed a good reputation and the kids wear wear ties, and you know, there's a very specific dress code. That sort of thing seems to have had a good impact. But now Perry announced a few months ago that he's leaving at the end of the school year. It's possible that that's an issue. When we were talking about this after the State Board of Ed meeting yesterday, and Jennifer Negerny, the director of the charter school's office, indicated that as best she can tell, the problem there is with recruiting new students as opposed to students who might be leaving because they have issues with the school or because they're disappointed that Perry is leaving or anything like that. So apparently it's an issue with recruiting new students. And that's kind of tricky, too, because the prestige is grades 5 through 8. Grade 5, going from 4th to 5th, is not a time when students typically transition into a new school. So, I mean, prestige may have to some extent built in its own little trap there, because this is not a time when a lot of kids are looking to switch schools. I mean, with all of the things that are going on with charters right now, there's just an awful lot of uncertainty in terms of what's really happening, especially in Wilmington.
And we'll wrap up with the last school that was put on review. What do we know about Academy of Dover? Financial mismanagement investigations ongoing there.
It's fair to say that we're going to know a lot more in 2 months by the time this formal review process is wrapped up in June. What we do know is that back in October, the school's head suddenly resigned. This coincided more or less with an auditing team doing an outside audit on the school, finding some irregularities, and then some of the school leadership found out, and the Department of Education found out, but they couldn't move on it because the audit was not complete. Mm-hmm. So they were waiting for that to be completed. A second auditing team is in. Meanwhile, the state auditor, Tom Wagner, is conducting his audit. The charter school's office will now be conducting its own investigation, which will be looking at the financial issues in a slightly different perspective. They're going to be looking, you know, Wagner's going to be looking at were any state laws violated, right, in the way money was spent or transactions were conducted. The charter school's office is going to be looking at very much the same information, but more with an eye toward, was the school managed properly? Was the school's board of directors, and its budget committee, paying any attention to what was going on? Were they managing properly? So there are a lot of different things going on here, a lot of moving targets. We have a vague idea of what has gone on, but it's going to take another 2 months for this all to get sorted out.
Our thanks to contributor Larry Nightingale for joining us this week. Again, his piece on this story is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. Next up on The Green, as Delaware's Jewish community commemorates Holocaust Remembrance Week, we speak with Steve Gonzer, producer of the film No Denying, Delawareans Bear Witness to the Holocaust. This is Delaware Public Media. This is The Green, and I'm Tom Byrne. According to numbers from the Bureau of Justice, there are over 20,000 inmates nationwide who are HIV positive, and between 81 and 90 of them are in correctional facilities in Delaware. While many inmates with HIV do receive medication, there's no system for following up with these individuals after they're released. Christiana Care, the University of Delaware, and the Howard R. Young Correctional Institution recently collaborated on a study to reform services for HIV-positive inmates and make sure they continue to be treated well after release. It was published in this month's issue of the Journal for Correctional Healthcare. Delaware Public Media science reporter Eli Chen spoke to Christy Vischer, director at UD's Center for Drug and Health Studies, to learn about the improvements made at one Delaware facility.
So let's start with the needs for HIV-positive inmates. What needs are there in terms of services, and how are they currently not being met?
HIV-positive inmates are at risk for relapse if they're not treated with a medication over a long period of time. And one of the things that happens is that inmates come into facilities, are treated because they have to under Supreme Court decisions, but then leave prison and may not restart or may not continue those medications.
And tell me about the study that you worked on. What was University of Delaware's role in this, and, you know, who were your collaborators?
The University of Delaware was a research partner for this project that was a multi-site study, actually involved 9 other sites, but University of Delaware was the site chosen for my project. And our collaborator for this project was Christiana Care Health Services and the HIV program up in Wilmington.
And tell me about the method that was mentioned in the study, the change teams that were used to facilitate or make sure that the inmates were consistently taking their medication.
So the change team approach actually originated in more of the health sciences literature as a way to help organizations implement evidence-based practices and make sure that those research practices actually get implemented into actual day-to-day clinical practice. And so it's a new area of science. We call it implementation science. And one of the strategies are to form change teams. Change teams being individuals who are working on the problem, and in this case, working on the problem both in the corrections institutions and in the community, and bring those groups of people together to talk about why things aren't working and whether they can identify solutions to make things work better.
Okay, so how do they interact with the HIV positive inmate?
What happens in facilities is that, as I said, they are treated with medication, and with the medical facilities and nurses and doctors that are in the facility. But then after they're released, there isn't any kind of what we call continuity of care. And so there had been no direct handoff to the community treatment provider up in Wilmington, the HIV program, to make sure that they were maintaining their treatment and staying on their regimen of drugs. So what the change team did was realize that there was this gap, that there wasn't this handoff happening. And so they developed some procedures to make sure that when an inmate was within, say, a couple of weeks of release, the community treatment provider was notified, and that there was a connection made between the medical staff in the facility and the community treatment provider to alert each other that this inmate was going to be released, he has these needs, and to make sure that there was an appointment made and that the individual was clear about when that appointment was and where he or she should show up for that continued treatment.
And this was being conducted at, your study was conducted at the Howard R. Young Correctional Facility, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, so can you talk about sort of the improvements that were made there and how you measured, I guess, the success of this program?
One of the things that we did was actually started with their intake into the facility. It's important for facilities to know whether someone's HIV positive. And previously to the study, that information could have been disclosed by the inmate, but it wasn't typically requested. So what the change team did was they realized this gap, and so they changed the intake form to have a specific question about whether or not the individual was HIV positive and whether or not the individual would like to be tested. And that actually led to more testing, which is a good thing, so that we know that individuals are HIV positive and can start them on treatment right away. We tracked individuals who were released who are HIV positive into the community to make sure that those connections were made. This was a single site study, so our numbers are very small. That's why it was important for the Delaware project to be part of this larger multi-site, multi-state project, actually, so that we could combine data from all of the other different sites. And once we did that, when we combined data from all of the other sites that were doing similar kinds of change teams, we found that actually HIV services were improved, comparing them to baseline, for prevention services, for testing services, and also more inmates were being linked to care than they had been previously before the study started.
And on that note, what are some of the challenges that exist in terms of implementing change teams in other state correctional facilities?
Correctional facilities obviously have a very specific mission. They are there to control a potentially violent population, and their primary mission is safety and security. So these kinds of healthcare-related issues are sort of lower on their priority list than things like officer safety or even inmate safety in facilities. And so unless the issue comes to the attention of the administrator as something that, quote, maybe keeps him up at night, these issues don't get addressed. So if it really takes an administrator or a senior person in the organization to point out that this is something that he or she feels is really important. And that's what we had in Delaware. We had a deputy director of corrections who was really passionate about HIV infection among inmates in the facilities. He felt, he thinks this is a very important problem, and he wanted to make some changes to make sure that inmates were appropriately being linked to care after they were released.
Is there a larger proportion of HIV positive inmates here in Delaware than in other states?
Delaware actually does have a high rate of HIV infection overall. The inmate overall inmate infection rate is about twice it is in the general population. But Delaware, because it sits in an unusual situation between New York and Pennsylvania and Baltimore and Washington, D.C., is on the I-95 corridor. It has high rates of HIV infection generally. And there's also a lot of drug-using offenders in this area, which is a correlate of HIV infection.
Right. And according to the statistics, about, I guess, 1% of all inmates across the country have HIV, but nonetheless, that is something that should be of concern, right?
Absolutely, because as I said, the rates of HIV infection among the correctional population are actually twice those of the general population. And one of the things that we found is that about a quarter of all of those people who are infected with HIV come through some kind of correctional facility within a year. So this is a good opportunity, whether you are show up in a jail or you show up in a prison, it's a good opportunity to make sure that these individuals who are infected are actually identified and then given the appropriate treatment to not only reduce their risk of later serious illness or even death, but also their risk to the community once they're released.
Our thanks to UD's Christy Vischer and Delaware Public Media Science reporter Eli Chen for their time this week. Stay with us. We talked to a local filmmaker about his efforts to help the First State remember the Holocaust next. But first, a check of local news from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green. I'm Tom Byrne. Around the world this week, people are observing Holocaust Remembrance Week. The commemoration was first established by the Israeli parliament to coincide with the liberation of concentration camps in Western Europe during World War II and the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, the largest Jewish-led revolt against the Nazis during that war. Steve Gonzer, a former training specialist in the Christina, Red Clay, and Newcastle County VOTEC school districts, spent 20 years creating a documentary about First State Holocaust survivors called No Denying, Delawareans Bear Witness to the Holocaust. The film started as a project with Wilmington's Helena Wind Preston Holocaust Education Center. Delaware Public Media's Kathy Carter recently spoke with Gonzer, and their conversation began by discussing more about the organization's roots.
That was started by two Wilmington survivors of the Holocaust over 30 years ago. Dorothy Finger and Helena Wynn Preston happened to meet in Wilmington, became friends, and decided that they needed to talk about their experience. So they got together and formed a small committee, and as time passed, it grew. And today, the committee has over 25 members, all volunteers made up of community leaders, clergy people, educators. And the mission of the committee is to educate the Delaware and Brandywine Valley community about the lessons to be learned from the Holocaust so that those atrocities are never repeated again. Since this year marks the 70th anniversary of the liberation of the death camp at Auschwitz and the end of World War II, the youngest survivors now are in their late 70s and early 80s. So our most important mission on our committee is to keep the torch burning, to talk to people about the lessons to be learned from this genocide.
Steve, you mentioned it's been nearly seven decades after World War II ended, so the final survivors of the Holocaust are aging and dying off. How confident are you that the tragedy's narrative will be carried on by the next generation of the younger generations?
Yeah, well, I'm very optimistic that that will happen. It's my biggest hope that it will. One of the things that's really important to be able to continue the discussion and the discourse is to teach young people about genocide and in various ways. I mean, through education in the schools And we're hoping that the children, which we call the second generation of the eyewitnesses, and the third generation will be the people to carry, you know, the torch, you know, for the future. It's critical that we do this. You know, genocide shouldn't be monopolized by any one group. And we see it today. We've seen it throughout history. The Holocaust, I think, is probably going to be the most studied genocide in modern history. And there's still people who deny it ever happened, which makes no sense. There's undisputed evidence. And when the eyewitnesses are no longer here to raise their voices, then we need someone to carry the torch. And we're hoping it'll be the second generation, people who are interested in preserving humanity and, you know, stopping the cancerous spread of genocide.
Steve, you spoke of how important it is for the second generation to continue telling these stories. Several years ago, the country of Israel made a call to citizens that if they had any photos, any artifacts, any mementos of the Holocaust, to please bring them forward to their Holocaust museum so that people can look back with these mementos and these artifacts, that there is proof and that these second generation people will be able to tell these stories for the young people.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And it's critical for family members, friends, and anyone who's familiar with eyewitnesses to gather as much personal data as possible. And the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington does the same thing. They're asking for people to bring in photographs, letters, documents that prove this happened. I know my own family, most of my grandmother's family was annihilated in the Holocaust, and there was nothing left. You know, I found a few letters and photos that I keep, and they're definitely going to be given, you know, to people to see them in exhibits. And that's critical. I hope people do that.
You mentioned it's critical for the story to keep being told, and you did that with a film. It's called No Denying, Delawareans Bear Witness to the Holocaust, 8-hour documentary on the Holocaust. How did you first come up with the idea of making this film?
Actually, it really grew out of determination and passion. I am not a documenter by trade or career. However, being a member of the Helena Wynn Preston Holocaust Education Committee, I felt it was absolutely critical to preserve for future generations the portrayals of individuals who are eyewitnesses to the Holocaust, since there's going to be no one left to speak for them soon. So I got involved with the committee, and we started to record the stories of individuals in Wilmington who were eyewitnesses to the Holocaust. And I took on the project, like I said, just determination and passion, and started out to make a little VHS tape, maybe 30 minutes long, to give to teachers to teach about the Holocaust in the classroom. Eventually, my passion grew and I became obsessed with the whole idea. And the eventual results were an 8-hour and 15-minute documentary featuring Delawareans who are eyewitnesses to the Holocaust, not just survivors, but the DVD set includes survivors, righteous Gentiles, rescued children, and liberators. So, you know, this at least will be people who you can see their faces, you could hear their voices, and these should be preserved for future generations.
And these DVDs and the materials that go with it to assist teachers are available in all Delaware public and parochial schools for classroom use. How important is it as a tool to teach children with these witness testimonies?
I think it's probably one of the best ways to do it, especially in this era of social media, visual and audio things, I think, reach people. I mean, and what I did was I did not have questions and answers for these people. Some of the people who appear in the documentary never talked about this ever, not with their children, not with their husbands, not with their wives, not with their friends, and living with these traumas for 40 or 50 or 60 years. So I did not want anything rehearsed. What I did was sat people down and just asked them to speak from their heart, which they did. So the impact has been pretty powerful. And again, especially for youth and young people who are not familiar with this particular genocide, I think if there's any goodness in anyone, and there is in everybody, you know, I believe that, you know, sincerely, that, you know, when they hear these stories, when they see actual faces and connect with people who are local, it resonates more intensely than reading a book or something. So I hope it has a great impact on people and that, you know, they'll learn about the horrors of and the consequences of indifference, discrimination, and hatred.
I read an article that I found interesting. I'm wondering your take on it.
Mm-hmm.
The author wrote that it's important to remember the Holocaust. It's important to remember the effect of the Holocaust. But it's also something that is not talked about as much, is that Jewish communities thrived before the Holocaust, and we don't talk about those thriving communities anymore.
They're lost and gone and forgotten. And it's kind of sad. What people don't talk about or realize is that the incredible impact of genocide for any group, but especially during the Holocaust, I mean, cultures were destroyed, whole villages were gone. I mean, I have relatives I know that survived. I have no idea where they are, who they are. I know I'll never see them again. So, yeah, it's incredible that, yeah, whole communities were gone. But what I like to do is expand my mind and think of genocide more in holistic and historical terms. And the Holocaust is probably unique in history because there's so much evidence. You know, had the Nazis not been so egotistical, organized, and recorded everything, there wouldn't be that much evidence. But these kind of atrocities have been going on forever. And communities in Cambodia, Armenia, villages were destroyed. So you could connect any topic or subject with this. But like you said, communities are destroyed. I mean, learning centers, you know, cultural, artistic communities just gone. You know, where there are millions of people living, there's like nobody left. Just wiped out. But genocide's not unique. It's pretty much same stuff, different day. And the DVD set is also in a lot of museums in the country and, you know, in Washington and in New York. So I'm pretty humble. I don't feel like I did anything unique. I mean, it's just a lot of people have done stuff like this. What's unique is that it's localized. There are people, you know, if you watch this, there are people you'll know in there. Just pick their lives up and start it all over again, but still live with that historical trauma that probably you'll never leave.
Which is why it's so crucial that we have these eyewitnesses.
You have to talk about it. I think the more we talk about it, the more we learn about it, the less likely we are to repeat it.
Our thanks to Steve Gonzer, chairperson of the Helena Wind Preston Holocaust Education Center. You can find out more about his documentary, No Denying, Delawareans Bear Witness to the Holocaust, at nodenying.org. Up next, our arts playlist takes us to the Delaware Theater Company to learn more about its Broadway-bound musical, Because of Winn-Dixie. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green, and I'm Tom Byrne. The Delaware Theater Company has a hit on its hands. Ticket sales for Because of Winn-Dixie are so strong, the Wilmington Playhouse has extended the musical's run. Because of Winn-Dixie is the first major theatrical production with a real dog on stage as a lead character, and Bill Berlone, Broadway's top animal trainer, is the man who trained the four-legged star, Bodie, a two-year-old labradoodle. In the show, a nine-year-old girl, recently abandoned by her mother, adopts the dog after it follows her home from a Winn-Dixie grocery store, and the dog helps her adjust to life in a new town. Based on the award-winning children's book, Because of Winn-Dixie has a top-notch creative team. The music was composed by Duncan Sheik, a two-time Tony Award winner, and the story and lyrics come courtesy of Nell Benjamin, who created Legally Blonde, the musical. In our arts playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kathy Carter chats with the pair, beginning with Nell Benjamin.
Nell, the author of the book, Kate DiCamillo, has described Because of Winn-Dixie as a hymn to dogs, friendship, and the South. How did you take the book and adapt it to the theater?
Well, we all loved the book when we read it. And the funny thing is that when I was sort of first approached about doing it, I thought, well, I don't want to do a children's musical. I've done children's musicals. I'm very proud of the children's musicals that I've done. But it didn't feel like something that I thought I wanted to do. But there's something about that book. There's a lot of nuance. There's many levels going on. And some of them get quite dark. Some of the storylines are much more adult issues, which I think is why it resonates so much with adults, but also with kids who realize there's a lot going on beneath a deceptively simple book. So it stuck with me after I said, no, I don't want to do a children's musical. And I thought, well, maybe we don't have to do a children's musical of this. And I was talking to Dorothy and Bill, who championed the project. And I said, if we did something a little more ambitious that was appropriate for families, but was truthful to the dark themes in the book, how would that be? And could we get a composer that you'd never think would work on a children's book? And they said, who? And I said, I don't know. We'd never get him, but Duncan Sheik, you know, someone like that. And they went to him. And he had the same reaction where he said, well, I don't want to do a children's musical. But then the book stayed with him as well. And eventually we all talked again and said, we know how to do this and we're going to try. So that, I think, was the turning point, the realizing that this book seems simple and seems child-friendly, but also addresses a lot of the drama that children can go through with families and loss and questions of faith. And we can bring those out and hopefully do in a way that's appropriate for everyone.
You mentioned Dorothy and Bill Berlone being champions of this book and, of course, the play. Give us a little bit of background.
Okay. I first worked with Bill Berlone, who is Broadway's preeminent animal trainer, on Legally Blonde, the musical, where he trained our chihuahuas, our chihuahua and our two chihuahua understudies. The story of Bill, when he was young, he wanted to be an actor, and he went up to Goodspeed to get an equity card, because Goodspeed, the opera house, had a program where if you worked, you know, did all the drudgery work in the world as an intern, one of the, I don't know, four interns would actually get an equity card. So he went up there, and the musical they were working on was the very first developmental iteration of Annie, the musical. And they hadn't planned on actually having Sandy the dog in the musical, but then they decided, no, we need the dog. So Michael Price, the artistic director, said, all right, fine. Interns, the one of you that gets me the dog and trains the dog for no money will get an equity card. So Bill said, great. And he went to a local animal shelter where he clapped eyes on Sandy, the Sandy. And it changed his life. He saved the dog. Annie, of course, became the big hit that everybody knows, and this started him down that road. And then Dorothy and Bill had optioned this book because of Winn-Dixie, because they truly felt that a dog could be a leading character in a show, and that it wouldn't be a question of just tricks put in at the last minute, but that he could teach the dog to play the character and in that way show the very deep bond between people and animals. And since that's been the sort of touchstone of his life, he wanted that to be the touchstone of the show. You know, these are strong themes, and there's a tremendous touching aspect to the book, but there's also a sense of bravery that the lead with this dog has the bravery to go out and confront all these issues. And I thought that was a really positive thing for us to have in the show.
The show is driven by the characters and, of course, their relationship to the lead character, which is a dog.
Yes.
How completely different is this experience from anything you've done? And what have you learned about yourself in the process?
In terms of having a lead that does not speak or act, that was a big challenge in every iteration of this, was to figure out how we give Winn-Dixie those moments without scripting them in a way, because he can't really do scripted anything. And bit by bit, we've discovered, and Bill and I have worked really closely together on this, what he can do and what those moments mean in the script. So we try not to do tricks or goofy things. The dog is not a Disney sidekick who can do magical behavior. He does just what a dog does, but he does it consistently at times in the plot that drive the plot. So, for instance, he follows her home in the beginning, and when you actually see it on stage, it seems dry to read Winn-Dixie follows her, but then when you actually see the moment and the audience all goes, oh, you know, it is quite lovely. So it has been different from anything, but incredibly rewarding in the same way. And I think the reaction that we get from the audience to see Opal and Winn-Dixie together is so worth it. It's so wonderful.
Going into this, you couldn't have known that the actor would have such a bond with the dog, and that is going to be so huge to the success of this show. Did you get very lucky with the dog that was cast?
We did. Well, you know, he is not our first Winn-Dixie. We did have a previous wonderful set of Irish wolfhounds. And what we learned, we made, again, very common sense decisions. We said we need big dogs who can read from the back of the house and calm dogs. And it would be great to have dogs that look like the book cover. And so we got those. And as it turned out, their very calmness and comfort on stage worked against us because they are very big dogs. And what would happen is they get so calm that after about a week of performances, they would start lying down, which again, fine for the scene. But then when our little tiny girl had to get them up, she had to lift sometimes physically 150 pounds worth of dog that would make a noise like, ugh. And the audience began to think, oh, does that dog not want to be there? Is she just dragging him around the stage? So Bodhi, our star now, he loves to be on stage. He has a spirit to him and a desire to perform that the audience picks up on. And again, how would we ever have known that had we not tried another dog first? We wouldn't have. It's sort of funny. You learn a lot about animal nature.
And it's Nell Benjamin, writer of the book and lyrics for Because of Winn-Dixie. Now we hand things over to the guy that made the music. It's Duncan Cheek. And Duncan, you said you were instantly inspired and had a pretty clear vision of what the music should sound like for this musical based on Nell's script. How did that come to you?
When I read the book, slightly begrudgingly, because I didn't really know how my own music was going to fit into the basic framework of what I knew about this story. But when I read the book, I was really charmed by it. And I thought, you know, this place in the Florida Panhandle is not a million miles away from where I grew up. I grew up in Hilton Head, South Carolina. So there were places kind of north of me that had an interesting set of Southern and colorful characters. And that book kind of really had that vibe. And I thought, you know, I could do something interesting where there might be some kind of exercises in genre. I mean, of course, I'm the composer, so it's still going to sound like my music. But I could kind of play with Southern rock and play with rockabilly and play with, you know, gospel and country and blues and have it be a kind of interesting movement through these different genres that kind of, you know, coalesce in the South.
There's been a lot of talk that this is a pre-Broadway show. What are your thoughts on it going to Broadway? Is it going to work for Broadway? And if it does, what is that going to mean for you?
Nobody knows what's going to work on Broadway and what's not going to work on Broadway. You know, Wicked kind of got mediocre reviews and people didn't really think it was going to happen at all. And 10 years later, it's a $5 billion entity. So, and I think, you know, things like Annie, which is maybe somewhat closer to the tenor of this show. I mean, that nobody really thought that was going to do the business either. And of course, it became this perennial kind of favorite. And even my own show, like Spring Awakening, our producers and our director, when we first did the show off-Broadway, would just say, this show is never going to go to Broadway. It's never going to work on Broadway. But, you know, sometimes they do work despite all that. And so musical theater is like this weird alchemy of things that kind of come together. And sometimes they really happen in this magical way, but you can't force it. It either happens or it doesn't. There's a fantastic team here, so there's no reason why it couldn't work, but it's totally up to the fates, you know.
You mentioned Spring Awakening, and of course, it was huge, won several Tonys. Can you take us back to the night of the Tonys when they announced Spring Awakening?
Well, yeah, I can. I was late. And my category was the first category, orchestration. So I remember like sitting down in my seat. And then I remember sort of hearing my name like somewhere in the room. And I had only written one speech because, you know, I didn't think I was going to win two Tonys. So I sort of gave my properly thought out speech for the orchestrations, which is not televised. And when we won the other one, I had nothing like intelligent to say at all. And it was just, I'm sure I was babbling and rambling, but that's okay. I was still in a pretty good mood afterwards.
Before you came to musical theater, did you have any kind of preconceived notions about it, what it might be, and that got turned on its head for you?
I was pretty bratty about musical theater. I did some musical theater as a, you know, elementary school kid, but by the time I was 12, 13, I was like, you know, I'm not doing song and dance. I'm playing guitar. It's way cooler. I'm getting my drum machine and my synthesizer. And so, you know, I went on this 20-year odyssey in the kind of normal music business, which I still, you know, it's still part of my day job. But then when, you know, after a bit of resistance to the idea of jumping into this different genre, I did think it would be interesting to try and write a score for a piece of theater where stylistically the music reflected more the stylistic tastes of the culture at large. Because musical theater, a lot of it, and even some of the greats, Stephen Sondheim et al., it's quite a niche stylistic thing. You have a certain set of people, intelligentsia and theater mavens, who idolize it, but the rest of the world doesn't really, it's not going to be their cup of tea. So my idea was kind of like, well, why can't you write a musical that, in the case of Spring Awakening, it was like, why can't you write a musical that reflects the tastes of the kind of indie rock culture that at the time I was interested in? And there were, you know, a lot of people listening to Radiohead and Bjork and that kind of music. And I thought, well, why can't that be the music that's coming out of the speakers and coming out of the singers on stage? So that was the initial conception of that idea. And, you know, since that time, now that I've been doing it for whatever, 10 or 12 years, I've come to respect and really love, you know, both contemporary theater composers and certainly all of the kind of amazing stuff that's, you know, in the canon. But it just took me a minute to expand my own my own consciousness about what I was willing to accept aesthetically.
If your contemporaries and your peers in the indie rock world or the indie rock fan were to give it a chance, they might appreciate it as well.
I think there are some things that they would totally love, yes, you know, and some things not, and that's fine. I mean, it, you know, musical theater certainly can and should cater to many different kind of demographics and psychographics, and that's all fine. But I do think it's important that there is some theater that's out there that appeals to teens and 20-somethings and 30-somethings who, you know, who listen to satellite radio and listen to Spotify and listen to pop music. It shouldn't be alienating to them.
And who is the audience for Because of Winn-Dixie?
Well, so at the risk of contradicting myself, I do think that this audience is more a kind of a young kind of preteen to teen and their parents kind of going to the theater and seeing a show about, frankly, a much beloved book. So to me, you know, I could say something very mercenary and just be like, yeah, we're trying to get the Annie kids of 2015 or the Wicked kids of, you know, 2015. But, you know, it's just, it does have a very broad appeal. You know, unlike some things I'm doing, American Psycho, for example, where, you know, you're not going to bring your 11-year-old kid to see that show. So it's been great to be able to work on things that are very, very different in tone because, you know, it keeps things interesting.
I think you're going back to a place where you mentioned earlier in the conversation that there's a space for all of this. There's a space for the indie people. There's a space for the families and something in between for the theater.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly hope that if your kind of normal indie rock person were to come to the show, I would hope that they would really respond to a lot of these songs because there is a real sophistication that's in there. And, you know, the way we've created the sound picture, it's not a million miles away from Sufjan Stevens or Mumford & Sons in many cases. But it's just, you know, there are some things that are a little more kind of theatrical, let's just say. So, you know, we'll see if we get a few of those audience types as well.
Our thanks to Duncan Sheik and Nell Benjamin for their time this week. Because of Winn-Dixie runs through May 10th at the Delaware Theater Company in Wilmington. For more information, visit DelawareTheater.org. Next on The Green, Enlighten Me, and another sample from our youth media project, Generation Voice. Stay with us. This is Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green. I'm Tom Byrne. This week, our Enlighten Me segment again spotlights Generation Voice, our youth media project that's completing its first year in the Brandywine School District at Mount Pleasant High School and its radio station, 91.7 WMPH. The work produced by students with help from our youth media producer Ann Hoffman and Mount Pleasant teacher Paul Wishengrad is showcased on our new website, generationvoice.org. And again this week on The Green, we offer a sample of what you'll find at that website. Since last August, a major cultural conversation has developed around the stories of unarmed black men killed by police officers. Michael Brown in Ferguson, Eric Garner in New York, and most recently Walter Scott in North Charleston, South Carolina. But it's less common to hear about how these events impact the emotional worlds of teens, particularly young men of color. Mikhail Clark loves collecting sneakers and listening to old school hip hop, but he struggles with anxiety. And ever since Michael Brown died last summer, the Mount Pleasant Junior says his fears around police have reached a fever pitch.
My name is Mikhail Clark. I'm originally from New York, but I moved to Delaware when I was 6. New York is still in my heart. Back in September, I went back to Long Island, to Wheatley Heights, to visit my grandmother. She likes to cook for me, and anything she makes, I consider special. My dad came along. He said he wanted to go to the barbershop and get a haircut. The barbershop, you know the rules. No fighting, that's like a win-win for me. I started thinking I can check out the sneaker store. But right when we came up with the idea of me heading out, my cousin calls, because he wanted to hang out too. While my dad was getting a haircut, my cousin and I went to the park. Every time I went back home, I would visit the park. This time I wasn't even playing. I was just chilling or whatever. And then this guy, he wasn't a police officer. He was like a security guard. And he yelled, "You guys, get out. The park's closed for maintenance." But there were no signs that said it was closed. At first, when I saw him from a distance, I didn't care. But then I saw on his face he wanted to bother us. Then as he started approaching us, I immediately got a little bit nervous. My father wasn't there. Normally I can handle myself, but I started thinking about Michael Brown, the unarmed teen who was shot and killed this summer in Ferguson. And I'm worried that I could try and ask this guy questions, and then the guard or the cop or whoever he was could take the situation in his hand. And if he wanted to hit me, he could do that. If he wanted to shoot me, he could even do that too. My heart was pounding. I was so focused on that guard that I didn't even go and check in on my cousin and see how he was reacting. But thankfully, the guy just told us to get the F out of there. Even though everything ended up peacefully, now I'm more afraid of cops than before. I'm already kind of an anxious person. I worry a lot about my dog, my homework, even my sneakers sometimes. But this anxiety is different. It's much different. My palms get sweaty, I have a fight or flight feeling, and a big lump in my throat. I feel like I have to be perfect, just to stay alive. But then I get frustrated that I can't just act like myself and be a kid. I want to like be safe and know that I can walk around without being nervous around cops. But at the same time, I want to stand up to injustice. What I'd really like to do is have a conversation with the cop. Tell them how I feel. I just don't want to get hurt or lose my life in the process.
Our thanks to Generation Voice student Mikhail Clark for enlightening us this week. You can check out his piece and other student work from our Youth Media Project in the Brandywine School District at our new website, generationvoice.org. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. A reminder, these stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at the new DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our recently revamped website. If you have comments about this week's show or story ideas for future shows, let us know about them. You can contact us via our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor Larry Nagengast, and from Generation Voice, Mount Pleasant High School junior Mikhail Clark, Delaware Public Media's Kathy Carter, Eli Chen and Ann Hoffman, as well as our station manager, Casey House. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne. Thanks so much for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.